Free of mind, mentalizing, or empathic accuracy is the ability to figure out what someone is thinking or feeling from their expressions, behavior, or circumstances. It allows us to infer, for instance, that a person who has just missed a train is probably upset and is now trying to figure out how to get to his or her destination on time. Mind reading does not require that we experience the person's experiences ourselves, nor that we care about them, only that we can figure out what they are. Mind reading may, in fact, comprise two abilities, one for reading thoughts, which is impaired in autism, the other for reading emotions, which is impaired in psychopathy. Some intelligent psychopaths do learn to read other people's emotional states, the better to manipulate them, though they still fail to appreciate the true emotional texture of those states. An example is a rapist who said of his victims, "They are frightened, right? But you see, I don't really understand it. I've been frightened myself, and it wasn't unpleasant." And whether or not they truly understand other people's emotional states, they simply don't care. Sadism, schadenfreude, and indifference to the welfare of animals are other cases in which a person may be fully cognizant of the mental states of other creatures, but unmoved to sympathize with them. People do, however, often feel distress at witnessing the suffering of another person. This is the reaction that inhibits people from injuring others in a fight, that made the participants in Milgram's experiment anxious about the shocks they thought they were delivering, and that made the Nazi reservists nauseous when they first started shooting Jews at close range. As these examples make all too clear, distress at another's suffering is not the same as sympathetic concern with their well-being. Instead, it can be an unwanted reaction which people may suppress, or an annoyance they may try to escape. Many of us, trapped on a plane with a screaming baby, feel plenty of distress, but our sympathy is likely to be more with the parent than with the child, and our strongest desire may be to find another seat. For many years, a charity called Save the Children ran magazine ads with a heartbreaking photograph of a destitute child and the caption, "You can save Juan Ramos for 5 cents a day, or you can turn the page." Most people turn the page. Emotions can be contagious. When you're laughing, the whole world laughs with you. That's why situation comedies have laugh tracks, and why bad comedians punch up their punchlines with a bada-bing rim shot that simulates a staccato burst of laughter. Other examples of emotional contagion are the tears at a wedding or funeral, the urge to dance at a lively party, the panic during a bomb scare, and the spreading nausea on a heaving boat. A weaker version of emotional contagion consists of vicarious responses, as when we wince in sympathy with an injured athlete or flinch when James Bond is tied to a chair and smacked around. Another is motor mimicry, as when we open our mouths when trying to feed applesauce to a baby. Many empathy fans write as if emotional contagion were the basis of the sense of empathy that is most pertinent to human welfare. The sense of empathy we value the most, though, is a distinct reaction that may be called sympathetic concern, or sympathy for short. Sympathy consists in aligning another entity's well-being with one's own, based on a cognizance of their pleasures and pains. Despite the easy equation of sympathy with contagion, it's easy to see why they're not the same. If a child has been frightened by a barking dog and is howling in terror, my sympathetic response is not to howl in terror with her, but to comfort and protect her. Conversely, I may have exquisite sympathy for a person whose suffering I cannot possibly experience vicariously, like a woman in childbirth, a woman who has been raped, or a sufferer of cancer pain. And our emotional reactions, far from automatically duplicating those of other people, can flip 180 degrees depending on whether we feel we are in alliance or competition with them. When a sports fan watches a home game, he is happy when the crowd is happy, and dejected when the crowd is dejected. When he watches an away game, he is dejected when the crowd is happy, and happy when the crowd is dejected. All too often, sympathy determines contagion, not the other way around. Today's empathy craze has been set off by scrambling the various senses of the word empathy. The confusion is crystallized in the meme that uses mirror neurons as a synonym for sympathy in the sense of compassion. Rifkin writes of so-called empathy neurons that allow human beings and other species to feel and experience another situation as if it were one's own, and concludes that we are a fundamentally empathic species, which seeks intimate participation and companionship with our fellows. The mirror neuron theory assumes that sympathy, which it blurs with contagion, is hardwired into our brains, a legacy of our primate nature, and has only to be exercised, or at least not repressed, for a new age to dawn. Unfortunately, Rifkin's promise of a leap to global empathic consciousness, and in less than a generation, is based on a dodgy interpretation of the neuroscience. In 1992, the neuroscientist Giacomo Rizzolatti and his colleagues discovered neurons in the brain of a monkey that fired both when the monkey picked up a raisin and when the monkey watched a person pick up a raisin. Other neurons responded to other actions, whether performed or perceived, such as touching and tearing. Though neuroscientists ordinarily can't impale the brains of human subjects with electrodes, we have reason to believe that people have mirror neurons too. Neuroimaging experiments have found areas in the parietal lobe and inferior frontal lobe that light up both when people move and when they see someone else move. The discovery of mirror neurons is important, though not completely unexpected. We could hardly use a verb in both the first person and the third person unless our brains were able to represent an action in the same way, regardless of who performs it. But the discovery soon inflated an extraordinary bubble of hype. One neuroscientist claimed that mirror neurons would do for neuroscience what DNA did for biology. Others, aided and abetted by science journalists, have touted mirror neurons as the biological basis of language, intentionality, imitation, cultural learning, fads and fashions, sports fandom, intercessory prayer, and, of course, empathy. A wee problem for the mirror neuron theory is that the animals in which the neurons were discovered, rhesus macaques, are a nasty little species with no discernible trace of empathy, or imitation, to say nothing of language. Another problem, as we shall see, is that mirror neurons are mostly found in regions of the brain that, according to neuroimaging studies, have little to do with empathy in the sense of sympathetic concern. Many cognitive neuroscientists suspect that mirror neurons may have a role in mentally representing the concept of an action, though even that is disputed. Most reject the extravagant claims that they can explain uniquely human abilities, and today virtually no one equates their activity with the emotion of sympathy. There are, to be sure, parts of the brain, particularly the insula, which are metabolically active both when we have an unpleasant experience and when we respond to someone else having an unpleasant experience. The problem is that this overlap is an effect rather than a cause of sympathy with another's well-being. Recall the experiment in which the insula lit up when a participant received a shock, and also when he or she watched an innocent person receiving a shock. The same experiment revealed that when the shock victim had cheated the male subjects out of their money, their insulas showed no response, while the striatum and orbital cortex lit up in sweet revenge. Empathy, in the morally relevant sense of sympathetic concern, is not an automatic reflex of our mirror neurons. It can be turned on and off and even inverted into counter-empathy, namely feeling good when someone else feels bad and vice versa. Revenge is one trigger for counter-empathy, and the flip-flopping response of the sports fan tells us that competition can trigger it as well. The psychologists John Lanzetta and Basil Inglis glued electrodes to the faces and fingers of participants and had them play an investment game with another bogus participant. They were told either that the two were working together or that they were in competition, though the actual returns did not depend on what the other participant did. Market gains were signaled by an uptick of a counter. Losses were signaled by a mild shock. When the participants thought they were cooperating, the electrodes picked up a visceral calming and a trace of a smile whenever their opposite number gained money, and a burst of sweat and the trace of a frown whenever he was shocked. When they thought they were competing with him, it went the other way. They relaxed and smiled when he suffered, and tensed up and frowned when he did well. The problem with building a better world through empathy, in the sense of contagion, mimicry, vicarious emotion, or mirror neurons, is that it cannot be counted on to trigger the kind of empathy we want, namely, sympathetic concern for others' well-being. Sympathy is endogenous, an effect rather than a cause of how people relate to one another. Depending on how beholders conceive of a relationship, their response to another person's pain may be empathetic, neutral, or even counter-empathic. In the previous chapter, we explored the circuitry of the brain that underlies our tendencies to violence. Now let's see the parts that underlie our better angels. The search for empathy in the human brain has confirmed that vicarious feelings are dimmed or amplified by the rest of the empathizer's beliefs. Klaus Lamm, Daniel Batson, and Jean DeSetti had participants take the perspective of a fictitious patient with ringing in his ears while he got treated with an experimental cure consisting of blasts of noise over headphones, which made the patient visibly wince. The pattern of activity in the participants' brains as they empathized with the patient overlapped with the pattern that resulted when they themselves heard the noise. One of the active areas was a part of the insula, the island of cortex that, as we have seen, represents literal and metaphorical gut feelings. Another was the amygdala, the almond-shaped organ that responds to fearful and distressing stimuli. A third was the anterior medial cingulate cortex, a strip of cortex on the inward-facing wall of the cerebral hemisphere that is involved in the motivational aspect of pain, not the literal stinging sensation, but the strong desire to turn it off. Studies of vicarious pain generally don't show activation in the parts of the brain that register the actual body sensation. That would be closer to a hallucination than to empathy. The participants were never put in the kind of situation that evokes counter-empathy, like competition or revenge, but their actions were pushed around by their cognitive construal of the situation. If they had been told that the treatment worked, so the patient's pain had been worthwhile, their brain's vicarious and distressed responses were damped down. The overall picture that has emerged from the study of the compassionate brain is that there is no empathy center with empathy neurons, but complex patterns of activation and modulation that depend on perceivers' interpretation of the straits of another person and the nature of their relationship with the person. A general atlas of empathy might look more or less as follows. The temporoparietal junction and nearby sulcus, groove in the superior temporal lobe, assess another person's physical and mental state. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the nearby frontal pole, the tip of the frontal lobe, compute the specifics of the situation and one's overall goals in it. The orbital and ventromedial cortex integrate the results of these computations and modulate the responses of the evolutionarily older, more emotional parts of the brain. The amygdala responds to fearful and distressing stimuli in conjunction with interpretations from the nearby temporal pole, the tip of the temporal lobe. The insula registers disgust, anger, and vicarious pain. The cingulate cortex helps to switch control among brain systems in response to urgent signals, such as those sent by circuits that are calling for incompatible responses, or those that register physical or emotional pain. And unfortunately for the mirror neuron theory, the areas of the brain richest in mirror neurons, such as parts of the frontal lobe that plan motor movements, the rearmost portions above the Sylvian fissure, and the parts of the parietal lobes that register the body sense are mostly uninvolved, except for the parts of the parietal lobes that keep track of whose body is where. In fact, the brain tissue that is closest to empathy in the sense of compassion is neither a patch of cortex nor a subcortical organ, but a system of hormonal plumbing. Oxytocin is a small molecule produced by the hypothalamus, which acts on the emotional systems of the brain, including the amygdala and striatum, and which is released by the pituitary gland into the bloodstream, where it can affect the rest of the body. Its original evolutionary function was to turn on the components of motherhood, including giving birth, nursing, and nurturing the young. But the ability of the hormone to reduce the fear of closeness to other creatures lent itself, over the course of evolutionary history, to being co-opted to supporting other forms of affiliation. They include sexual arousal, heterosexual bonding in monogamous species, marital and companionate love, and sympathy and trust among non-relatives. For these reasons, oxytocin is sometimes called the cuddle hormone. The reuse of the hormone in so many forms of human closeness supports a suggestion by Batson that maternal care is the evolutionary precursor of other forms of human sympathy. In one of the odder experiments in the field of behavioral economics, Ernst Fehr and his collaborators had people play a trust game in which they hand over money to a trustee who multiplies it and then returns however much he feels like to the participant. Half the participants inhaled a nasal spray containing oxytocin, which can penetrate from the nose to the brain, and the other half inhaled the placebo. The ones who got the oxytocin turned over more of their money to the stranger, and the media had a field day with fantasies of car dealers misting the hormone through their showroom ventilating systems to snooker innocent customers. So far, no one has proposed spraying it from crop dusters to accelerate global empathic consciousness. Other experiments have shown that sniffing oxytocin makes people more generous in an ultimatum game, in which they divide a sum while anticipating the response of a recipient who can veto the deal for both of them, but not in a dictator game, where the recipient has to take it or leave it, and the proposer needn't take his reaction into account. It seems likely that the oxytocin network is a vital trigger in the sympathetic response to other people's beliefs and desires. In Chapter 4, I alluded to Peter Singer's hypothesis of an expanding circle of empathy, really a circle of sympathy. Its innermost kernel is the nurturance we feel toward our own children, and the most reliable trigger for this tenderness is the geometry of the juvenile face, the phenomenon of perception we call cuteness. In 1950, the ethologist Conrad Lorenz noted that entities with measurements typical of immature animals evoke feelings of tenderness in the beholder. The lineaments include a large head, cranium, forehead, and eyes, and a small snout, jaw, body, and limbs. The cuteness reflex was originally an adaptation in mothers to care for their own offspring, but the triggering features may have been exaggerated in the offspring themselves, to the extent they are compatible with its own health, to tilt the mother's response toward nurturance and away from infanticide. Species that are lucky enough to possess the geometry of babies may elicit the awe response from human beholders and benefit from our sympathetic concern. We find mice and rabbits more adorable than rats and possums, doves more sympathetic than crows, baby seals more worthy of protection than mink and other weaselly fur bearers. Cartoonists exploit the reflex to make their characters more lovable, as do the designers of teddy bears and anime characters. In a famous essay on the evolution of Mickey Mouse, Stephen Jay Gould plotted an increase in the size of the rodent's eyes and cranium during the decades in which his personality changed from an obnoxious brat to a squeaky clean corporate icon. Gould did not live to see the 2009 makeover in which the Walt Disney Company, concerned that today's children expect edgier, more dangerous characters, unveiled a video game in which Mick's features had de-evolved to a more rat-like anatomy. As we saw in Chapter 8, cuteness is a nuisance to conservation biologists because it attracts disproportionate concern for a few charismatic mammals. One organization figured they might as well put the response to good use and branded itself with the doe-eyed panda. The same trick is used by humanitarian organizations who find photogenic children for their ad campaigns. The psychologist Leslie Zebrowitz has shown that juries treat defendants with more juvenile facial features more sympathetically, a travesty of justice we can attribute to the workings of our sense of sympathy. Physical beauty is yet another sympathy-induced injustice. Unattractive children are punished more harshly by parents and teachers and are more likely to be victims of abuse. Unattractive adults are judged to be less honest, kind, trustworthy, sensitive, and even intelligent. Of course, we do manage to sympathize with our adult friends and relatives, including the ugly ones. But even then, our sympathy is spread not indiscriminately, but within a delimited circle within which we apply a suite of moral emotions. Sympathy has to work in concert with these other emotions because social life cannot be a radiation of warm and fuzzy feelings in all directions. Friction is unavoidable in social life. Toes get stepped on, noses put out of joint, fur rubbed the wrong way. Together with sympathy, we feel guilt and forgiveness, and these emotions tend to apply within the same circle. The people we sympathize with are the people we feel guilty about hurting, and the people we find easiest to forgive when they hurt us. Roy Baumeister, Arlene Stilwell, and Todd Heatherton reviewed the social psychological literature on guilt and found that it went hand in hand with empathy. More empathic people are also more guilt-prone, particularly women who excel at both emotions, and it is the targets of our empathy who engage our guilt. The effect is enormous. When people are asked to recall incidents that made them feel guilty, 93% involved families, friends, and lovers. Only 7% involved acquaintances or strangers. The proportions were similar when it came to memories of eliciting guilt. We guilt-trip our friends and families, not acquaintances and strangers. Baumeister and his collaborators explained the pattern with the distinction we will return to in the section on morality. Sympathy and guilt, they note, operate within a circle of communal relationships. They are less likely to be felt in exchange or equality-matching relationships, the kind we have with acquaintances, neighbors, colleagues, associates, clients, and service providers. Exchange relationships are regulated by norms of fairness and are accompanied by emotions that are cordial rather than genuinely sympathetic. When we harm them, or they harm us, we can explicitly negotiate the fines, refunds, and other forms of compensation that rectify the harm. When that is not possible, we reduce our distress by distancing ourselves from them or derogating them. The businesslike quid pro quo negotiations that can repair an exchange relationship are, we shall see, generally taboo in our communal relationships, and the option of severing a communal relationship comes with a high cost. So we repair our communal relationships with the messier but longer-lasting emotional glue of sympathy, guilt, and forgiveness. So what are the prospects that we can expand the circle of sympathy outward from babies, fuzzy animals, and the people bound to us in communal relationships to lasso in larger and larger sets of strangers? One set of predictions comes from the theory of reciprocal altruism and its implementation in tit-for-tat and other strategies that are nice in the technical sense that they cooperate on the first move and don't defect until defected upon. If people are nice in this sense, they should have some tendency to be sympathetic to strangers, with the ultimate, that is, evolutionary goal, of probing for the possibility of a mutually beneficial relationship. Sympathy should be particularly likely to spring into action when an opportunity presents itself to confer a large benefit to another person at a relatively small cost to oneself. That is, when we come across a person in need. It should also be fired up where there are common interests that grease the skids toward a mutually beneficial relationship, such as having similar values and belonging to a common coalition. Neediness, like cuteness, is a general elicitor of sympathy. Even toddlers go out of their way to help someone in difficulty or to comfort someone in distress. In his studies of empathy, Batson found that when students are faced with someone in need, such as a patient recovering from leg surgery, they respond with sympathy, even when the needy one falls outside their usual social circle. The sympathy is triggered whether the patient is a fellow student, an older stranger, a child, or even a puppy. The other day I came across an overturned horseshoe crab on the beach, its dozen legs writhing uselessly in the air. When I righted it and it slithered beneath the waves, I felt a surge of happiness. With less easily helped individuals, a perception of shared values and other kinds of similarity makes a big difference. In a seminal experiment, the psychologist Dennis Krebs had student participants watch a second, fake participant play a perverse game of roulette that paid him whenever the ball landed on an even number and shocked him when it landed on an odd number. The player had been introduced either as a fellow student in the same field who had a similar personality, or as a non-student with a dissimilar personality. When the participants thought they were similar to the player, they sweated and their hearts pounded more when they saw him get shocked. They said they felt worse while anticipating his shock and were more willing to get shocked themselves and forego payments to spare their counterpart additional pain. Krebs explained the sacrifice of his participants on behalf of their fellows with an idea he called the empathy-altruism hypothesis. Empathy encourages altruism. The word empathy, as we have seen, is ambiguous. And so we are really dealing with two hypotheses. One, based on the sympathy sense, is that our emotional repertoire includes a state in which another person's well-being matters to us. We are pleased when the person is happy and upset when he or she is not, and that this state motivates us to help them with no ulterior motive. If true, this idea, let's call it the sympathy-altruism hypothesis, would refute a pair of old theories called psychological hedonism, according to which people only do things that give them pleasure, and psychological egoism, according to which people only do things that provide them with a benefit. Of course, there are circular versions of these theories, in which the very fact that a person helps someone is taken as proof that it must feel good or benefit him, if only to scratch an altruistic itch. But any testable version of these cyclical theories must identify some independent ulterior motive for the help extended, such as assuaging one's own distress, avoiding public censure, or garnering public esteem. The word altruism is ambiguous, too. The altruism in the empathy-altruism hypothesis is altruism in the psychological sense of a motive to benefit another organism as an end in itself, rather than as a means to some other end. This differs from altruism in the evolutionary biologist sense, which is defined in terms of behavior rather than motives. Biological altruism consists of behavior that benefits another organism at a cost to oneself. Biologists use the term to help distinguish the two ways in which one organism can benefit another. The other way is called mutualism, where an organism benefits another one while also benefiting itself, as with an insect pollinating a plant, a bird eating ticks off the back of a mammal, and roommates with similar tastes enjoying each other's music. In practice, the biologists' and psychologists' sense of altruism often coincide, because if we have a motive to do something, we're often willing to incur a cost to do it. And despite a common misunderstanding, evolutionary explanations for biological altruism, such as that organisms benefit their kin or exchange favors, both of which help their genes in the long run, are perfectly compatible with psychological altruism. If natural selection favored costly helping of relatives or of potential reciprocation partners because of the long-term benefits to the genes, it did so by endowing the brain with a direct motive to help those beneficiaries, with no thought of its own welfare. The fact that the altruist's genes may benefit in the long run does not expose the altruist as a hypocrite or undermine her altruistic motives, because the genetic benefit never figures as an explicit goal in her brain. The first version of the empathy-altruism hypothesis, then, is that psychological altruism exists and that it is motivated by the emotion we call sympathy. The second version is based on the projection and perspective-taking senses of empathy. According to this hypothesis, adopting someone's viewpoint, whether by imagining oneself in his or her shoes, or imagining what it is like to be that person, induces a state of sympathy for the person, which would then impel the perspective-taker to act altruistically toward the target if the sympathy-altruism hypothesis is true as well. One might call this the perspective sympathy hypothesis. This is the hypothesis relevant to the question raised in chapters 4 and 5 of whether journalism, memoir, fiction, history, and other technologies of vicarious experience have expanded our collective sense of sympathy and helped drive the humanitarian revolution, the long peace, the new peace, and the rights revolutions. Though Batson doesn't always distinguish the two versions of the empathy-altruism hypothesis, his two-decade-long research project has supported both of them. Let's start with the sympathy-altruism hypothesis and compare it to the cynical alternative in which people help others only to reduce their own distress. Participants in one study watched an ersatz fellow participant, Elaine, get repeatedly shocked in a learning experiment. The male participants were introduced to Charlie rather than Elaine. Elaine becomes visibly upset as the session proceeds, and the participant is given an opportunity to take her place. In one condition, the participant has finished her obligation to the experimenter and is free to leave, so taking Elaine's place would be genuinely altruistic. In another, the participant doesn't take Elaine's place and has to watch Elaine get shocked for another 8 sessions. Batson reasoned that if the only reason people volunteer to take poor Elaine's place is to reduce their own distress at the sight of her suffering, they won't bother if they are free to leave. Only if they have to endure the sight and sound of her moaning will they prefer to get shocked themselves. As in Krebs's experiment, the participant's sympathy was manipulated by telling her either that she and Elaine had the same values and interests, or that they had incompatible ones. For example, if the participant read Newsweek, Elaine would be described as reading Cosmo and 17. Sure enough, when participants felt themselves to be similar to Elaine, they relieved her of being shocked, whether or not they had to watch her suffer. If they felt themselves to be different, they took her place only when the alternative was to watch the suffering. Together with other studies, the experiment suggests that by default, people help others egoistically to relieve their own distress at having to watch them suffer. But when they sympathize with a victim, they are overcome by a motive to reduce her suffering, whether it eases their distress or not. Another set of experiments tested a second ulterior motive to helping, namely, the desire to be seen as doing the socially acceptable thing. This time, rather than manipulating sympathy experimentally, Batson and his collaborators exploited the fact that people spontaneously vary in how sympathetic they feel. After the participants heard Elaine worrying aloud about the impending shocks, they were asked to indicate the degree to which they felt sympathetic, moved, compassionate, tender, warm, and soft-hearted. Some participants wrote high numbers next to these adjectives. Others wrote low ones. Once the procedure began and long-suffering Elaine started getting zapped and was visibly unhappy about it, the experimenters used sneaky ways of assessing whether any desire on the part of the participants to relieve her distress sprang from pure beneficence or a desire to look good. One study tapped the participants' mood with a questionnaire, and then either gave them the opportunity to relieve Elaine by doing well on a task of their own, or simply dismissed Elaine without the participant being able to claim any credit. The empathizers felt equally relieved in both cases, the non-empathizers only if they were the ones that set her free. In another, the participants had to qualify for an opportunity to take Elaine's place by scoring well in a letter-finding task they had been led to believe was either easy, so there was no way to fake a bad performance and get off the hook, or hard, so they could take a dive and plausibly get out of being asked to make the sacrifice. The non-empathizers took the dive and did worse in the so-called hard task. The empathizers did even better on the hard task, where they knew an extra effort would be needed to allow them to suffer in Elaine's stead. The emotion of sympathy, then, can lead to genuine moral concern in Kant's sense of treating a person as an end and not a means to an end. In this case, not even as a means to the end of feeling good about having helped the person. In these experiments, a person was rescued from a harm caused by someone else, the experimenter. Does sympathy-induced altruism dampen one's own tendency to exploit someone or to retaliate in response to a provocation? It does. In other experiments, Batson had women play a one-shot prisoner's dilemma in which they and a fictitious fellow participant bid cards that could net them various numbers of raffle tickets, framed as a business transaction. Most of the time, they did what game theorists say is the optimal strategy. they defected. They chose to bid a card that protected them against being a sucker and that offered them the chance to exploit their partner, while leaving them with a worse outcome than if the two of them had cooperated by bidding a different card. But when the participant read a personal note from her otherwise anonymous partner and was induced to feel empathy for her, her rate of cooperating jumped from 20% to 70%. In a second experiment, a new group of women played an iterated prisoner's dilemma game, which gave them an opportunity to retaliate against a partner's defection with a defection of their own. They cooperated in response to a defection only 5% of the time. But when they were induced beforehand to empathize with their partner, they were far more forgiving and cooperated 45% of the time. Sympathy, then, can mitigate self-defeating exploitation and costly retaliation. In these experiments, sympathy was manipulated indirectly by varying the similarity in values between a participant and the target, or it was entirely endogenous. The experimenters counted on some participants spontaneously being more empathetic than others, for whatever reason. The key question for understanding the decline of violence is whether sympathy can be pushed around exogenously. Sympathy, recall, tends to be expressed in communal relationships, the kind that are also accompanied by guilt and forgiveness. Anything that creates a communal relationship, then, should also create sympathy. A prime communality builder is inducing people to cooperate in a project with a superordinate goal. The classic example is the warring boys at the robbers' cave camp who had to pull together to haul a bus out of the mud. Many conflict resolution workshops operate by a similar principle. They bring adversaries together in friendly surroundings where they get to know each other as individuals, and they are tasked with the superordinate goal of figuring out how to resolve the conflict. These circumstances can induce mutual sympathy, and the workshops often try to help it along with exercises in which the participants adopt each other's viewpoints. But in all these cases, cooperation is being forced upon the participants, and it's obviously impractical to get billions of people together in supervised conflict resolution workshops. The most powerful exogenous sympathy trigger would be one that is cheap, widely available, and already in place, namely the perspective taking that people engage in when they consume fiction, memoir, autobiography, and reportage. So the next question in the science of empathy is whether perspective taking from media consumption actually engages sympathy for the writers and talking heads and for members of the groups they represent. In several studies, the Batson team convinced participants they were helping with market research for the university radio station. They were asked to evaluate a pilot show called News from the Personal Side, a program that aimed to go beyond the facts of local events to report how these events affect the lives of the individuals involved. One set of participants was asked to focus on the technical aspects of the broadcast and take an objective perspective toward what is described, not getting caught up in the feelings of the interview subject. Another set was asked to imagine how the person who is interviewed feels about what has happened and how it has affected his or her life. A manipulation of the perspective taking that ought to instill a state of sympathy. Admittedly, the manipulation is a bit ham-handed. People are not generally told how to think and feel as they read a book or watch the news. But writers know that audiences are most engaged in a story when there is a protagonist whose viewpoint they are seduced into taking. As in the old advice to aspiring scriptwriters, find a hero, put him in trouble. So presumably, real media also rope their audiences into sympathy with a lead character without the need for explicit orders. A first experiment showed that the sympathy induced by perspective taking was as sincere as the kind found in the studies of Jacques Delaine. Participants listened to an interview with Katie, who lost her parents in a car crash and was struggling to bring up her younger siblings. They were later presented with an opportunity to help her out in small ways, such as babysitting and giving her lifts. The experimenters manipulated the sign-up sheet so that it looked either as if a lot of students had put their names down, creating peer pressure for them to do the same, or as if only two had, allowing the students to feel comfortable ignoring her plight. The participants who had focused on the technical aspects of the interview signed up to help only if many of their peers had done so. The ones who had listened from Katie's point of view signed up regardless of what their peers had done. It's one thing to sympathize with a character in need, but it's another to generalize one's sympathy to the group that the character represents. Do readers sympathize just with Uncle Tom or with all African-American slaves? With Oliver Twist or with orphaned children in general? With Anne Frank or with all victims of the Holocaust? In an experiment designed to test for such generalizations, students listened to the plight of Julie, a young woman who had contracted AIDS from a blood transfusion after a car accident. The experiment was run before effective treatments had been discovered for that often fatal disease. Well, as you can imagine, it's pretty terrifying. I mean, every time I cough or feel a bit run down, I wonder, is this it? Is this the beginning, you know, of the slide? Sometimes I feel pretty good, but in the back of my mind, it's always there. Any day I could take a turn for the worse. Pause. And I know that, at least right now, there's no escape. I know they're trying to find a cure, and I know that we all die. But it all seems so unfair, so horrible, like a nightmare. Pause. I mean, I feel like I was just starting to live, and now, instead, I'm dying. Pause. It can really get you down. Later, when the students were asked to fill out a questionnaire on attitudes toward people with AIDS, the perspective takers had become more sympathetic than the technical evaluators, showing that sympathy had indeed spread from the individual to the class she represented. But there was an important twist. The effect of perspective taking on sympathy was gated by moralization, as we might expect from the fact that sympathy is not an automatic reflex. When Julie confessed to having contracted the disease after a summer of unprotected, promiscuous sex, the perspective takers were more sympathetic to the broad class of victims of AIDS, but they were no more sympathetic to the narrower class of young women with AIDS. Similar results came out of a study in which students of both sexes listened to the plight of a man who became homeless, either because he had come down with an illness or because he had grown tired of working. The team of psychologists then pushed the outside of the envelope by seeing how much sympathy they could induce for convicted murderers. It's not that anyone necessarily wants people to develop warm feelings toward murderers, but at least some degree of sympathy for the unsympathetic may be necessary to oppose cruel punishments and frivolous executions, and we can imagine that a grain of sympathy of this sort may have led to the reforms of criminal punishment during the humanitarian revolution. Batson didn't press his luck by trying to induce sympathy for a psychopathic predator, but he artfully invented a typical crime blotter homicide in which the perpetrator had been provoked by a victim who was not much more likable than he was. Here is James's story of how he came to kill his neighbor. Pretty soon, things went from bad to worse. He'd dump garbage over the fence into my backyard. I sprayed red paint all over the side of his house. Then he set fire to my garage with my car in it. He knew that car was my pride and joy. I really loved it and kept it in great shape. By the time I woke up and they got the fire out, the car was ruined, totaled, and he just laughed. I went crazy, not yelling. I didn't say anything, but I was shaking so hard I could hardly stand up. I decided right then that he had to die. That night when he came home, I was waiting on his front porch with my hunting rifle. He laughed at me again and said I was chicken, that I didn't have the guts to do it. But I did. I shot him 4 times. He died right there on the porch. I was still standing there, holding the gun, when the cops came. Interviewer, do you regret doing it? Now? Sure. I know that murder is wrong, and that nobody deserves to die like that. Not even him. But at the time, all I wanted was to make him pay. Big. And to get him out of my life. Pause. When I shot him, I felt this big sense of relief and release. I felt free. No anger, no fear, no hate. But that feeling lasted only a minute or two. He was the one that was free. I was going to be in prison for the rest of my life. Pause. And here I am. The perspective takers did feel a bit more sympathy for James himself than did the technical evaluators, but it translated into just a sliver of a more positive attitude toward murderers in general. But then there was a twist on the twist. A week or two later, the participants got a phone call out of the blue from a pollster who was doing a survey on prison reform. The caller was in cahoots with the experimenters, but none of the students figured this out. Tucked into the opinion poll was an item on attitudes toward murderers, similar to one in the questionnaire that the students had filled out in the lab. At this distance, the effects of perspective taking made a difference. The students who had tried a couple of weeks before to imagine what James had been feeling showed a noticeable bump in their attitude toward convicted murderers. The delayed influence is what researchers in persuasion call a sleeper effect. When people are exposed to information that changes their attitudes in a way they don't approve of, in this case, warmer feelings toward murderers, they are aware of the unwanted influence and consciously cancel it out. Later, when their guard is down, their change of heart reveals itself. The upshot of the study is that even when a stranger belongs to a group that people are strongly inclined to dislike, listening to his story while taking his perspective can genuinely expand their sympathy for him and for the group he represents, and not just during the few minutes after hearing the story. People in a connected world are exposed to the stories of strangers through many channels, including face-to-face encounters, interviews in the media, and memoirs and autobiographical accounts. But what about the portion of their information stream that is set in make-believe worlds, the fictional stories, films, and television dramas in which audiences voluntarily lose themselves? The pleasure in a story comes from taking a character's vantage point and in comparing the view to that from other vantage points, such as those of the other characters, of the narrator, and of the reader himself or herself. Could fiction be a stealthy way to expand people's sympathy? In an 1856 essay, George Eliot defended this psychological hypothesis. Appeals founded on generalizations and statistics require a sympathy ready-made, a moral sentiment already in activity. But a picture of human life, such as a great artist can give, surprises even the trivial and the selfish into that attention to what is apart from themselves, which may be called the raw material of moral sentiment. When Scott takes us into Lucky Mucklebackit's cottage or tells the story of the two drovers, when Wordsworth sings to us the reverie of poor Susan, when Kingsley shows us Alton Locke gazing yearningly over the gate which leads from the highway into the first wood he ever saw, when Hornung paints a group of chimney sweepers, more is done towards linking the higher classes with the lower, towards obliterating the vulgarity of exclusiveness, than by hundreds of sermons and philosophical dissertations. Art is the nearest thing to life. It is a mode of amplifying experience and extending our contact with our fellow men beyond the grounds of our personal lot. Today, the historian Lynn Hunt, the philosopher Martha Nussbaum, and the psychologists Raymond Marr and Keith Oatley, among others, have championed the reading of fiction as an empathy expander and a force toward humanitarian progress. One might think that literary scholars would line up to join them, eager to show that their subject matter is a force for progress in an era in which students and funding are staying away in droves. But many literary scholars, such as Suzanne Keene in Empathy in the Novel, bristle at the suggestion that reading fiction can be morally uplifting. They see the idea as too middlebrow, too therapeutic, too kitsch, too sentimental, too Oprah. Reading fiction can just as easily cultivate schadenfreude, they point out, from gloating over the misfortunes of unsympathetic characters. It can perpetuate condescending stereotypes of the other, and it can siphon sympathetic concern away from the living beings who could benefit from it and toward appealing victims who don't actually exist. They also note, correctly, that we don't have a trove of good laboratory data showing that fiction expands sympathy. Marr, Oatley, and their collaborators have shown that readers of fiction have higher scores on tests of empathy and social acumen, but that correlation doesn't show whether reading fiction makes people more empathic or empathic people are more likely to read fiction. It would be surprising if fictional experiences didn't have similar effects to real ones, because people often blur the two in their memories, and a few experiments do suggest that fiction can expand sympathy. One of Batson's radio show experiments included an interview with a heroin addict who the students had been told was either a real person or an actor. The listeners who were asked to take his point of view became more sympathetic to heroin addicts in general, even when the speaker was fictitious, though the increase was greater when they thought he was real. And in the hands of a skilled narrator, a fictitious victim can elicit even more sympathy than a real one. In his book, The Moral Laboratory, the literary scholar Yemelyan Hakamolder reports experiments in which participants read similar facts about the plight of Algerian women through the eyes of the protagonist in Malakai Mukaddem's novel, The Displaced, or from Jan Goodwin's nonfiction expose, Price of Honor. The participants who read the novel became more sympathetic to Algerian women than those who read the true life account. They were less likely, for example, to blow off the women's predicament as a part of their cultural and religious heritage. These experiments give us some reason to believe that the chronology of the humanitarian revolution, in which popular novels preceded historical reform, may not have been entirely coincidental. Exercises in perspective taking do help to expand people's circle of sympathy. The science of empathy has shown that sympathy can promote genuine altruism, and that it can be extended to new classes of people when a beholder takes the perspective of a member of that class, even a fictitious one. The research gives teeth to the speculation that humanitarian reforms are driven in part by an enhanced sensitivity to the experiences of living things and a genuine desire to relieve their suffering. And as such, the cognitive process of perspective taking and the emotion of sympathy must figure in the explanation for many historical reductions in violence. They include institutionalized violence such as cruel punishments, slavery, and frivolous executions, the everyday abuse of vulnerable populations such as women, children, homosexuals, racial minorities, and animals, and the waging of wars, conquests, and ethnic cleansings with a callousness to their human costs. At the same time, the research reminds us why we should not aim for an age of empathy or an empathic civilization as the solution to our problems. Empathy has a dark side. For one thing, empathy can subvert human well-being when it runs afoul of a more fundamental principle, fairness. Batson found that when people empathized with Sherry, a 10-year-old girl with a serious illness, they also opted for her to jump a queue for medical treatment ahead of other children who had waited longer or needed it more. Empathy would have consigned these children to death and suffering because they were nameless and faceless. People who learned of Sherry's plight but did not empathize with her acted far more fairly. Other experiments make the point more abstractly. Batson found that in a public goods game, where people can contribute to a pool that gets multiplied and redistributed to the contributors, players who were led to empathize with another player, for example by reading about how she had just broken up with her boyfriend, diverted their contributions to her, starving the public commonwealth to everyone's detriment. The trade-off between empathy and fairness is not just a laboratory curiosity. It can have tremendous consequences in the real world. Great harm has befallen societies whose political leaders and government employees act out of empathy by warmly doling out perquisites to kin and cronies rather than heartlessly giving them away to perfect strangers. Not only does this nepotism sap the competence of police, government, and business, but it sets up a zero-sum competition for the necessities of life among clans and ethnic groups, which can quickly turn violent. The institutions of modernity depend on carrying out abstract fiduciary duties that cut across bonds of empathy. The other problem with empathy is that it is too parochial to serve as a force for a universal consideration of people's interests. Mirror neurons notwithstanding, empathy is not a reflex that makes us sympathetic to everyone we lay eyes upon. It can be switched on and off, or thrown into reverse by our construal of the relationship we have with a person. Its head is turned by cuteness, good looks, kinship, friendship, similarity, and communal solidarity. Though empathy can be spread outward by taking other people's perspectives, the increments are small, Batson warns, and they may be ephemeral. To hope that the human empathy gradient can be flattened so much that strangers would mean as much to us as family and friends is utopian in the worst 20th century sense, requiring an unattainable and dubiously desirable quashing of human nature. Nor is it necessary. The ideal of the expanding circle does not mean that we must feel the pain of everyone else on Earth. No one has the time or energy, and trying to spread our empathy that thinly would be an invitation to emotional burnout and compassion fatigue. The Old Testament tells us to love our neighbors, the New Testament to love our enemies. The moral rationale seems to be, love your neighbors and enemies. That way you won't kill them. But frankly, I don't love my neighbors, to say nothing of my enemies. Better then is the following ideal. Don't kill your neighbors or enemies, even if you don't love them. What really has expanded is not so much a circle of empathy as a circle of rights, a commitment that other living things, no matter how distant or dissimilar, be safe from harm and exploitation. Empathy has surely been historically important in setting off epiphanies of concern for members of overlooked groups. But the epiphanies are not enough. For empathy to matter, it must goad changes in policies and norms that determine how the people in those groups are treated. At these critical moments, a newfound sensitivity to the human costs of a practice may tip the decisions of elites and the conventional wisdom of the masses. But as we shall see in the section on reason, abstract moral argumentation is also necessary to overcome the built-in strictures on empathy. The ultimate goal should be policies and norms that become second nature and render empathy unnecessary. Empathy, like love, is, in fact, not all you need. Self-control. Ever since Adam and Eve ate the apple, Odysseus had himself tied to the mast, the grasshopper sang while the ant stored food, and St. Augustine prayed, "Lord, make me chaste, but not yet." Individuals have struggled with self-control. In modern societies, the virtue is all the more vital because now that we have tamed the blights of nature, most of our scourges are self-inflicted. We eat, drink, smoke, and gamble too much, max out our credit cards, fall into dangerous liaisons, and become addicted to heroin, cocaine, and email. Violence, too, is largely a problem of self-control. Researchers have piled up a tall stack of risk factors for violence, including selfishness, insults, jealousy, tribalism, frustration, crowding, hot weather, and maleness. Yet almost half of us are male, and all of us have been insulted, jealous, frustrated, or sweaty without coming to blows. The ubiquity of homicidal fantasies shows that we are not immune to the temptations of violence, but have learned to resist them. Self-control has been credited with one of the greatest reductions of violence in history, the 30-fold drop in homicide between medieval and modern Europe. Recall that according to Norbert Elias's theory of the civilizing process, the consolidation of states and the growth of commerce did more than just tilt the incentive structure away from plunder. It also inculcated an ethic of self-control that made continence and propriety second nature. People refrained from stabbing each other at the dinner table and amputating each other's noses at the same time as they refrained from urinating in closets, copulating in public, passing gas at the dinner table, and gnawing on bones and returning them to the serving dish. A culture of honor, in which men were respected for lashing out against insults, became a culture of dignity, in which men were respected for controlling their impulses. Reversals in the decline of violence, such as the developed world in the 1960s, and the developing world following decolonization were accompanied by reversals in the valuation of self-control, from the discipline of elders to the impetuousness of youth.